I looked at the zebra, still perched on his throne of lifeless animal carcasses, and I growled at it very softly but very ominously. And the demon knew. The demon knew not to mess with me that night. Not that night, or ever again.
40. Oh, a breath of September! The vacations were done. The lawyers were back at work. The courts were at full staff. The postponements were finished. The truth would be had. He left that morning wearing the only suit he owned, a crumpled khaki two-piece from Banana Republic and a dark tie. He looked very good. "Mike will come by at lunch and take you for a walk," he said to me. "I don't know how long this will go." Mike came and walked me briefly through the neighborhood so I wouldn't be lonely, and then he left again. Later that afternoon, Denny returned. He smiled down at me. "Do I need to reintroduce you two?" he asked. And behind him was Zoe. I leapt in the air. I bounded. I knew it! I knew Denny would vanquish the evil twins. I felt like doing flips. Zoe had returned. It was an amazing afternoon. We played in the yard, we ran and laughed, we hugged and cuddled. We made dinner together and sat at our table and ate. It felt so good to be together again. After dinner, they ate ice cream in the kitchen. "Are you going back to Europe soon?" Zoe asked out of the blue. Denny froze in place. The story had worked so well, Zoe still believed it. He sat down across from her. "No, I'm not going back to Europe," he said. Her face lit up. "Yay!" she cheered. "I can have my room back." "Actually," Denny said, "I'm afraid not yet." Her forehead crinkled and her lips pursed as she attempted to puzzle out his statement. I was puzzled, too. "Why not?" she asked finally, frustration in her voice. "I want to come home." "I know, honey, but the lawyers and judges have to make the decision on where you'll live. It's part of what happens when someone's mommy dies."
"Just tell them," she demanded. "Just tell them that I'm coming home. I don't want to live there anymore. I want to live with you and Enzo."
"It's a little more complicated than that," Denny hemmed.
"Just tell them," she repeated angrily. "Just tell them."
"Zoe, someone has accused me of doing something very bad."
"Just tell them."
"Someone said I did something very bad, and even though I know I didn't do it, now I have to go to court and prove to everyone that I didn't do it." Zoe thought about it for a moment.
"Was it Grandma and Grandpa?"
she asked. I was very impressed with the laser-like accuracy of her inquiry. "Not," Denny started. "No, no, it wasn't them, but they know about it."
"I made them love me too much,"
Zoe said softly, looking into her bowl of melted ice cream.
"I should have been bad. I should have made them not want to keep me."
"No, honey, no," Denny said, dismayed. "Don't say that. You should shine with all of your light all the time. I'll work this out. I promise I will." Zoe shook her head without meeting his eyes. Understanding that the conversation was over, Denny cleared her bowl and began to clean the dishes. I felt badly for them both, but more so for Zoe, who continued to face situations that were loaded with subtleties beyond her experience and fraught with the conflicting desires of those around her, fighting for supremacy like vines entangled on a trellis. Sadly, she went into her bedroom to play with the animals she had left behind. Later in the evening, the doorbell rang. Denny answered it. Mark Fine was there. "It's time," he said. Denny nodded and called for Zoe.
"This was a major victory for us, Dennis," Mark said. "It means a lot. You understand that, right?"
Denny nodded, but he was sad, like Zoe.
"Every other weekend, Friday after school until Sunday after dinner, she's yours," Mark said. "And every Wednesday, you pick her up after school and deliver her before 8 o'clock, right?"
"Right," Denny said. Mark Fine looked at Denny for a long time without speaking.
"I'm fucking proud of you," he said finally. "I don't know what goes on in that head of yours, but you're a fucking competitor."
Denny breathed in deeply.
"That's what I am," he agreed.
And Mark Fine took Zoe away. She had just returned, and she was going away again. It took me some time to fully grasp the situation, but I understood ultimately that the court case earlier in the day was not Denny's criminal trial, but a custody hearing, a hearing that had been delayed over and over,
put off for months because the lawyers were going to their houses on Lopez Island with their own families, and the judge was going to Cleellum, to his ranch. I felt betrayed. I knew that those people, those officials of the court, had no clue as to the feelings I had witnessed that night at the dinner table. If they had, they would have stopped everything, canceled all of their other obligations, and ensured a swift resolution to our situation. As it was, we had taken only our first step. The restraining order had been quashed. Denny had won visitation rights, but Zoe was still in the custody of the evil twins. Denny was still on trial for a felony charge he didn't deserve. Nothing had been solved. And yet, I had seen them together. I had seen them look at each other and giggle with relief, which reaffirmed my faith in the balance of the universe. And while I understood that we had merely successfully navigated the first turn of a very long race, I felt that things boded well for us. Denny was not one to make mistakes, and with fresh tires and a full load of fuel, he would prove a formidable foe to anyone challenging him. 41. The flash and fury of a sprint race is grand. The strategies and skill of a race of 500 miles is spectacular. But the race for the true racer is the enduro. 8 hours, 12 hours, 24, even 25. I introduce you to one of the forgotten names in automotive racing history, Luigi Chinetti. Chinetti was a tireless driver who participated in every motorsports race at Le Mans from 1932 through 1953. He is mostly known for winning the first ever Ferrari victory at the 24 Hours of Le Mans in 1949. Chinetti drove more than 23 and one half of those 24 hours. For 20 minutes, he relinquished control of the car to his co-driver, Peter Mitchell Thompson, the car's owner, a baron from Scotland. That is all. Chinetti drove all but 20 minutes of the 24 hours, and he won. A brilliant driver, mechanic, and businessman, Luigi Chinetti later convinced Ferrari to sell their cars in the United States, and he convinced them to grant him the first, and for many years the only, Ferrari dealership in this country. He sold expensive red automobiles to very rich people, and they paid very rich prices for their toys. Chinetti always kept his client list confidential, shunning the garish light of conspicuous consumption. A great man, Luigi Chinetti. Clever and smart and resourceful. He died in 1994 at the age of 93 years. I often wonder who he is now, who possesses his soul. Does a child know his own spiritual background, his own pedigree? I doubt it. But somewhere, a child surprises himself with his endurance, his quick mind, his dexterous hands. Somewhere, a child accomplishes with ease that which usually takes great effort. And this child, who has been blind to his past, but whose heart still beats for the thrill of the race, this child's soul awakens. And a new champion walks among us. 42. How quickly a year passes, like a mouthful of food snatched from the maw of eternity. How quickly. With little drama, comparatively speaking, to mark the months, they slipped by one, until another fall lay before us. And still, almost nothing had changed. Back and forth, round and round, the lawyers danced and played their game, which was merely a game to them, but not to us. Denny took Zoe on schedule every other weekend, every Wednesday afternoon. He took her to places of cultural enrichment, art museums, science exhibits, the zoo and the aquarium. He taught her things, and sometimes, on secret missions, he took us to the go-karts. Ah, the electric carts. She was just big enough to fit when he took her, and she was good. She knew the carts immediately, as if she had been born to them. She was quick. How quickly. With little instruction, she climbed behind the wheel, tucked her golden hair into a helmet, buckled her harness, and was off. No fear, no hesitation, no waiting. "You take her to Spanaway?" the worker boy asked Denny after her very first session. Spanaway was a place south of us where children often practiced go-karting on an outdoor course. "Nope," Denny replied. "'Cause she could kick your ass," the kid said. "I doubt it,"
Denny laughed. The worker kid glanced nervously at the clock. He looked through the glass barrier to the cash register people. It was mid-afternoon, after the lunch rush, and before anyone showed up for the evening activities. The place was empty except for us. They only let me in because I had been there before, and I had never created a problem.
"So take a session," the kid said. "She wins, you pay. You win, you don't pay."
"You're on," Denny said, grabbing a helmet from the rack of helmets that people can borrow. He hadn't bothered to bring his own. They started their race, a flying start, with Denny giving Zoe a bit of an edge, taking it easy on her. For several laps, he dogged her, staying on her back tires, let her know he was there. Then he tried to pass her, and she slammed the door on him. He tried again to pass. She slammed the door. Again, same result. It was like she knew where he was at every moment, in a cart with no mirrors, wearing a helmet that allowed no peripheral vision. She felt him. She knew. When he made his moves, she shut him down. Every single time. Consider that she had a tremendous advantage, being only 60 pounds to his 150. That's a huge weight differential in karting. Still, consider that he was a 30-year-old semi-professional race car driver, and she was a 7-year-old neophyte. Consider the possibilities. She took the checker. God bless her little soul. She took the checker and beat her old man. And I was so happy. I was so happy that I didn't mind it when I had to wait in the car while they went into Andy's diner for French fries and milkshakes. How did Denny sustain himself for the duration of this ordeal? Here's how. He had a secret. His daughter was better and quicker and smarter than he was. And while the evil twins may have restricted his ability to see her, when he was allowed to see her, he received all the energy he needed to maintain his focus.
43.
"This is not a conversation I like to have," Mark Fine said, leaning back on the iron chair until it groaned with fatigue. "It's one I have too often."
Spring again. Victrola. Dark chocolate eyes.
I slept at my master's feet on the sidewalk of 15th Avenue, which had been warmed by the sun like a cooking stone. Slept and sprawled, barely lifting my head to acknowledge the occasional petting I received from the passers-by, all of whom, on some level, wanted to be more like me, able to enjoy a nap in the sun without guilt, without worry. Little did they know that, in fact, I was quite apprehensive, as I always was at our meetings with Mark.
"I'm ready," Denny said.
"Money." Denny nodded to himself and sighed.
"I've missed some invoices."
"You owe me a shitload, Dennis," Mark clarified. "I've been giving you slack, but I have to cut you off."
"Give me another 30 days of slack," Denny said.
"Can't do it, friend."
"Yes, you can," Denny said firmly. "Yes, you can."
Mark sucked on his latte.
"I have investigators, lie detector specialists, paralegals, support staff. I have to pay these people."
"Mark," Denny said, "I'm asking you for a favor. Give me 30 days.
"You'll be paid in full?"
Mark asked. 30 days. Mark finished his coffee drink and stood.
"Okay, 30 days. Our next meeting is at Cafe Vita."
"Why Cafe Vita?" Denny asked.
"My dark chocolate eyes. They left for a richer roast. She's at Cafe Vita, so that's where our next meeting will be. As long as you pay your bill. 30 days.
"I'll pay," Denny said. "You keep working."
44. The solution had been put to Denny by Mark Fine. If Denny were to quit his claim to Zoe, the criminal charges would vanish. That's what Mark Fine said. As simple as that. Of course, that was speculation on his part. The evil twins didn't tell him that outright, but drawing on his experience, Mark Fine knew. Because the mother of the girl was Trish's cousin was part of it, and also because their lawyer had made it clear in the initial hearings that they did not wish for Denny to spend any time in jail for his offense. They simply wanted him to be registered as a sex offender. Sex offenders don't get custody of their little girls.
"They're very devious," Mark noted, "and very good."
"As good as you?" Denny wondered.
"No one is as good as me, but they're very good."
At one point, Mark even counseled Denny that perhaps the best thing for Zoe would be to stay with her grandparents, as they were better able to provide for the comforts of her childhood, as well as pay for her college education when that became necessary. Further, Mark suggested, were Denny not to be the principal caregiver for Zoe, he would be much more able to accept instructing and driving jobs out of state, as well as participate in racing series worldwide, if he so chose. He noted that a child needs a stable home environment, which, he said, could be best provided in a single housing location and with consistent schooling, preferably in the suburbs or at a private school in an urban neighborhood. Mark assured Denny he would settle for nothing short of a liberal visitation schedule. He spent quite a long time convincing Denny of these truths. I wasn't convinced. Of course, I understood that a race car driver must be selfish. Success at any endeavor on an elite level demands selfishness. But for Mark Fine to say Denny should put his own needs above the needs of his family because concurrent success in both fields was impossible was simply wrong. Many of us have convinced ourselves that compromise is necessary to achieve our goals, that all of our goals are not attainable, so we should eliminate the extraneous, prioritize our desires, and accept less than the moon. But Denny refused to yield to that idea. He wanted his daughter, and he wanted his racing career, and he refused to give up one for the other. Things change quickly on a race course. I remember watching one of Denny's races when I had accompanied him to the track and was looked after by his crew. We watched near the start-finish line as, with one lap remaining, Denny was in third place behind two other cars. They drove past us, and when they came back around for the checkered flag, Denny was by himself. He won the race. When asked how he had overtaken two cars on the final lap, he simply smiled and said that when he saw the starter wag one finger, meaning it was the last lap, he got a flash, and he said to himself, "I will win this race." One of the racers ahead of him spun off the track. The other locked up his wheels and gave Denny an easy opening to pass. "It's never too late," Denny said to Mark. "Things change." Very true. Things change quickly. And as if to prove it, Denny sold our house. We had no money left. They had sucked him dry. Mark had threatened to cease working for Denny's defense. There was little else Denny could do. He rented a truck from U-Haul and called on his friends. And one weekend that summer, we moved all of our belongings from our house in the Central District to a one-bedroom apartment on Capitol Hill. I loved our house. It was small, I know. Two bedrooms and one bathroom. And the yard was too small for a good running. And sometimes at night the buses on the street were too loud. But I had grown attached to my spot in the living room on the hardwood floor, which was very warm in the winter when the sun streamed in through the window. And I loved using my dog door, which Denny had installed for me so I could venture into the backyard at will. I would often go out on the back porch on a cold and rainy day when Denny was at work and sit and breathe and watch the movement of the tree branches and smell the rain. But that was no more. That was gone. From that point forward, my days were spent in an apartment with carpeting that smelled of chemicals, insulated windows that didn't breathe properly, and a refrigerator that hummed too loudly and seemed to work too hard to keep the food cold, and no cable TV. Still, I tried to make the best of it. If I squeezed myself into the corner between the arm of the sofa and the sliding glass door that opened onto a balcony that was too small to be considered a balcony at all, if I wedged myself just so, I could see past the building across the street, and through a narrow gap, I could see the Space Needle with its little bronze elevators that tirelessly whisked visitors from the ground to the sky and back again. 45. Denny paid his account with Mark Fine. Shortly afterward, Mark Fine was appointed to be a circuit judge, something about which I know little except that it is a lifetime appointment, it is quite prestigious, and it is not refusable. Denny found a new lawyer who didn't meet at Cafe Vita or Victrola Coffee because he didn't care for young girls with eyebrow piercings and chocolate eyes. Whereas Mark Fine was a letter B, this new one was a letter L. Mr. Lawrence. Laconic. Laid-back. Lugubrious. Mark had spark and fire. This one had very large ears. This one asked for a continuance, which is what you can do in the legal world if you need time to read all the paperwork. And while I understood it was necessary, I was still concerned. Mark Fine had carried himself with the energy of someone who had already won the game and was politely waiting for you to count the chips to discover your loss. Mr. Lawrence might have been very capable,
but he carried himself more like a hound without a hunt. A let-me-know-when-you're-ready look on his sad face. And so, while it had seemed like we were getting close to the reckoning, suddenly the horizon shot away from us, and again, we were waiting for the legal wheels to turn, which they did, but exceedingly slowly. Shortly after Denny began working with our new representation, we received more bad news. The evil twins were suing Denny for child support. Dastardly is how Mark Fine had described them. So now, in addition to taking his child from him, they demanded he pay for the food they fed her? Mr. Lawrence defended their action as a legitimate tactic, ruthless as it might be. He posed to Denny a question.
Does the end always justify the means?
And then he answered it.
Apparently for them, it does.
I have an imaginary friend. I call him King Karma. I know that karma is a force in this universe, and that people like the evil twins will receive karmic justice for their actions. I know that this justice will come when the universe deems it appropriate, and it may not be in this lifetime, but in the next, or the one after that. The current consciousness of the evil twins may never feel the brunt of the karma they have incurred, though their souls absolutely will. I understand this concept, but I don't like it. And so my imaginary friend does things for me. If you are mean to someone, King Karma will swoop out of the sky and call you names. If you kick someone, King Karma will bound from an alley and kick you back. If you are cruel and vicious, King Karma will administer a fitting punishment. At night, before I sleep, I talk to my imaginary friend, and I send him to the evil twins, and he exacts his justice. It may not be much, but it's what I can do. Every night, King Karma gives them very bad dreams, in which they are chased mercilessly by a pack of wild dogs until they awaken with a start, unable to fall asleep again. 46. It was an especially difficult winter for me. Perhaps it was the stairs in our apartment building, or maybe it was my genetic deficiency catching up to me, or maybe I was just tired of being a dog. I so longed to shed this body, to be free of it. I spent my lonely, joyless days watching the people who walked by on the street below, all going somewhere, all with important destinations, and me, unable to unlock the door and go greet them. And even if I had been able to greet them, I had a dog's tongue, and therefore would have been unable to speak to them, unable to shake their hands. How I wanted to talk to these people. How I wanted to engage them in life. I wanted to participate, not just to observe. I wanted to judge the world around me, not merely be a supportive friend. And looking back, I can tell you it was my state of mind, it was my outlook on life, that attracted me to that car. And attracted that car to me. That which we manifest is before us. We walked back from Volunteer Park late in the night, extending our usual quick jaunt because of the special weather conditions. It was not too cold and not too warm. A gentle breeze blew, and snow fell from the sky. I was unsettled by the snow. I remember, Seattle is rain. Warm rain or cold rain, Seattle is rain. Seattle is not snow. There are far too many hills for Seattle to be able to tolerate snow, and yet there was snow. Denny often allowed me to walk home from the park without my leash, and that night I strayed too far from him. I was watching the flakes fall and gather in a thin layer on the sidewalk and on the street, ahead on 10th Avenue, which was devoid of both cars and people. "Yo, Zoe!" he called. He whistled for me, his sharp whistle. I looked up. He was on the other side of Aloha. He must have crossed without my noticing. "Come here, boy." He slapped his thigh, and feeling detached from him, feeling somehow like there was a world between us, not merely a two-lane road, I bounded toward him into the street. He suddenly cried out, "No, wait!" The tires did not scream as tires do. The ground was covered with a thin layer of snow. The tires hushed. They shushed. And then the car hit me. So stupid, I thought. I am so stupid. I am the stupidest dog on the planet, and I have the audacity to dream of becoming a man? I am stupid. "Settle down, boy." His hands were on me. warm.
I didn't see.
I know.
He shot out.
I totally understand. I saw the whole thing. Denny lifted me. Denny held me.
What can I do?
I'm several blocks from home. He's too heavy to carry. Will you drive me?
Sure, but...
You tried to stop. The street is snowy.
I've never hit a dog before.
You just clipped him.
I'm totally freaking.
He's more scared than he is anything else.
I've never hit...
What just happened isn't important, Denny said. Let's think about what's going to happen next. Get in your car.
Yeah,
the boy said. He was just a boy. A teenager.
Where should I go?
Everything's fine, Denny said, sliding into the back seat with me on his lap. Take a deep breath, and let's drive. 47. Ayrton Senna did not have to die. This came to me in a flash, as I lay whimpering in pain in the back seat of Denny's car on the way to the animal hospital that night. It came to me on the Grand Prix circuit in the town of Imola, in the Tamburello corner. Senna did not have to die. He could have walked away. Saturday, the day before the race, Senna's friend and protege, Rubens Barrichello, was seriously injured in an accident. Another driver, Roland Ratzenberger, was killed during a practice session. Senna was very upset about the safety conditions of the track. He spent Sunday, race morning, assembling the other drivers to form a new driver's safety group. Senna was elected the head of the group. People say that he was so ambivalent about that race, the San Marino Grand Prix, that he thought seriously of retiring as a driver on Sunday morning. He almost quit. He almost walked away. But he did not walk away. He raced that fateful first day of May in 1994. And when his car failed to turn in at the fabled Tamburello Corner, a corner known for its excessive danger and speed, his car left the track at nearly 190 miles per hour and struck a concrete barrier. He was killed instantly by a piece of suspension that penetrated his helmet. Or he died in the helicopter on the way to the hospital. Or he died on the track after they had pulled him out of the wreckage. Enigmatic is Ayrton Senna, in death as well as in life. To this day, there is still great controversy over his death. Onboard camera footage mysteriously disappeared. Accounts of his death differed. The politics of the Fédération Internationale de l'Automobile came into play. It is true that in Italy, if a driver dies while on the track, the death is investigated immediately and the race is stopped. It is true that if a race were to be stopped in such a way, millions of dollars would be lost by the FIA, its sponsors, the track, television revenue, and so forth. Commerce would be affected. Whereas if that same driver were to die in a helicopter, for instance, en route to the hospital, the race could continue. It is also true that the first man to reach Senna after that moment, Sidney Watkins, said, "We lifted him from the cockpit and laid him on the ground. As we did, he sighed, and, although I am totally agnostic, I felt his soul departed at that moment." What is the real truth regarding the death of Ayrton Senna, who was only 34 years old? I know the truth, and I will tell you now. He was admired, loved, cheered, honored, respected, in life as well as in death. A great man he is. A great man he was. A great man he will be. He died that day because his body had served its purpose. His soul had done what it came to do, learned what it came to learn, and then was free to leave. And I knew, as Denny sped me toward the doctor who would fix me, that if I had already accomplished what I set out to accomplish here on Earth, if I had already learned what I was meant to learn, I would have left the curb 1 second later than I had, and I would have been killed instantly by that car. But I was not killed, because I was not finished. I still had work to do. 48. Separate entrances for cats and dogs. That's what I remember most. And still another entrance for infectious animals, which did not discriminate by genus. Apparently dogs and cats are equal when they are infectious. I remember the doctor painfully manipulating my hips. Then he gave me a shot, and I was very much asleep. When I awoke, I was still groggy, but no longer in pain. I heard snippets of conversation,
terms like dysplasia and chronic arthritis and non-displaced fracture of the pelvic bone. Others like replacement surgery and salvage operation, knitting and pain threshold, calcification and fusing, and my favorite, old. Denny carried me to the lobby and laid me down on the brown carpeting, which was somehow comforting in the dim room. The assistant spoke to him and said more things that were confusing to me due to my drugged state. X-ray, sedative, examination and diagnosis, cortisone injection, pain medications, nighttime emergency fee, and, of course, $812. Denny handed the assistant a credit card. He kneeled down and stroked my head. "You'll be all right, so," he said. "You cracked your pelvis, but it will heal. You'll just take it easy for a while, and you'll be good as new." "Mr. Swift?" Denny stood and returned to the counter. "Your card has been declined." Denny stiffened. "That's not possible. Do you have another card?" "Here." They both watched the blue machine that took the cards, and a few moments later, the assistant shook his head. "You've exceeded your limit." Denny frowned and took out another card. "Here's my ATM card. It will work." They waited again. Same result. "That's not right," Denny said. I could hear his breath quicken, his heart beat faster. "I just deposited my paycheck. Maybe it hasn't cleared yet." The doctor appeared from the back. "Problem?" he asked. "Look, I have $300 from when I deposited my check. I took some of it out in cash. Here." Denny fanned the bills in front of the doctor. "They must be holding the rest of the check or something, waiting for it to clear," Denny said, his voice sounding panicky. "I know I have money in that account, or I can transfer some into it tomorrow morning from my savings." "Relax, Denny," the doctor said. "I'm sure it's just a misunderstanding." He said to the assistant, "Write Mr. Swift a receipt for the $300 and leave a note for Susan to run the card in the morning for the balance." The assistant reached out and took Denny's cash. Denny watched closely as the young man wrote up the receipt. "Could I keep 20 of it?" Denny asked hesitantly. I could see his lip quivering. He was exhausted and shaken and embarrassed. "I need to put some gas in my car." The assistant looked to the doctor, who lowered his eyes and nodded silently and turned away, calling goodnight over his shoulder. The assistant handed Denny a $20 bill and a receipt, and Denny carried me to the car. When we got home and Denny placed me on my bed, he sat in the dark room, lit only by the street lamps outside, and he held his head in his hands for a long time. "I can't," he said. "I can't keep going." I looked up, and he was talking to me. He was looking at me. "They won," he said. "You see?" How could I respond? What could I say? "Can't even afford to take care of you," he said to me. "I can't even afford gas for my car. I've got nothing left, Enzo. There's nothing left." Oh, how I wished I could speak. How I wished for thumbs. I could have grabbed his shirt collar. I could have pulled him close to me, so close he could feel my breath on his skin, and I could have said to him, "This is just a crisis. A flash, a single match struck against the implacable darkness of time. You are the one who taught me never to give up. You taught me that new possibilities emerge for those who are prepared, for those who are ready. You have to believe." But I couldn't say that. I could only look at him. "I tried," he said. He said that because he couldn't hear me, because he had not heard a word I just said, because I am a dog. "You are my witness," he said. "I tried." If I could have stood on my hind legs, if I could have raised my hands and held him, if I could have spoken to him. "I have not witnessed," I would have said. "I am witnessing." And he would have understood what I meant, and he would have realized. But he could not hear me, because I am what I am. And so he returned his head to his hands, and he sat. I provided nothing. He was alone. 49. Days later, a week, two, I don't know. After Denny's deflation, time meant little to me. He looked sickly, he had no energy, no life force, and so neither did I. At a point when my hip still bothered me, not so long as to have healed, not so soon that the pain was acute, we went to visit Mike and Tony. They didn't live far from us. Their house was small, but reflected a different level of income. Tony had stood in the right place at the right time, Denny once told me, and would never have to worry about money again. Such is life. Such is manifesting. Your car goes where your eyes go. We sat in their kitchen, Denny with a cup of tea and a manila folder before him. Tony wasn't present. Mike paced nervously.
It's the right decision, Den, Mike said. I totally support you.
Denny didn't move, didn't speak, just stared dully at the folder.
This is your youth, Mike said. This is your time. Principle is important, but so is your life. So is your reputation.
Denny nodded.
Lawrence got what you wanted him to get, right?
Denny nodded.
Same visitation schedule, but with 2 weeks in the summer and 1 week over Christmas break and the February school break, Mike asked.
Denny nodded.
And you don't have to pay support anymore. They'll put her in a private school on Mercer Island, and they'll pay for her college education.
Denny nodded.
And they'll settle for misdemeanor harassment and probation, no sex offense on your record?
Denny nodded.
Denny, Mike said seriously, you're a smart guy, one of the smartest guys I've ever met. Let me tell you, this is a smart decision. You know that, right?
Denny looked confused for a moment, scanned the tabletop, checked his own hands.
I need a pen, he said.
Mike reached behind him to the telephone table and picked up a pen. He handed it to Denny. Denny hesitated, his hand poised over the documents in the folder. He looked up at Mike.
I feel like they've sliced open my guts, Mike. Like they've sliced me open and cut out my intestines, and I'll have to carry around a plastic shit bag for the rest of my life. For the rest of my life, I'll have this plastic bag of shit tied to my waist and a hose, and whenever I empty my shit bag into the toilet, I'll have to think about how they cut me open and gutted me, and I just lay there with a dead smile on my face and said, well, at least I'm not broke.
Mike seemed at a loss.
It's rough, he said.
Yeah, Denny agreed.
It's rough. Nice pen.
Denny held up the pen. It was one of those souvenir pens with the sliding thing in the plastic top with the liquid.
Woodland Park Zoo, Mike said.
I looked closer. The top of the pen, a little plastic savanna. The sliding thing, a zebra. When Denny tipped the pen, the zebra slid across the plastic savanna. The zebra is everywhere. I suddenly realized. The zebra. It is not something outside of us. The zebra is something inside of us. Our fears, our own self-destructive nature. The zebra is the worst part of us when we are face to face with our worst times. The demon is us. Denny brought the tip of the pen to the paper, and I could see the zebra sliding forward, inching toward the signature line. And I knew it wasn't Denny who was signing. It was the zebra. Denny would never give up his daughter for a few weeks of summer vacation and an exemption from child support payments. I was an old dog, recently hit by a car, and yet I mustered what I could, and the pain medication Denny had given me earlier helped with the rest. I pushed up onto his lap with my paws. I reached out with my teeth, and the next thing I knew, I was standing at the kitchen door with the papers in my mouth and both Mike and Denny staring at me, completely stunned.
Enzo!
Denny commanded.
Drop it!
I refused.
Enzo, drop!
He yelled. I shook my head.
Come here, boy,
Mike said. I looked over at him. He was holding a banana, playing good cop to Denny's bad cop, which was totally unfair. He knew how much I loved bananas. But still, I refused.
Enzo, get the hell over here, Denny shouted,
and he lunged at me. I slipped away. It was a low-speed chase, to be sure, my mobility being restricted as it was, but it was a chase nonetheless. One in which I fainted and dodged and slid and evaded the hands that grasped for my collar. I held them off. I still had the papers, even when they cornered me in the living room. Even when they were about to catch me and wrest the papers from my jaws, I had a chance. I was trapped, I know. But Denny taught me that the race isn't over until the checker flies. I looked around and noticed that one of the windows was open. It wasn't open much, and there was a screen on it. But it was open, and that was enough. Despite all of my pain, I lunged. With all of my might, I dove. I cleared the opening. I crashed into that screen and through it, and suddenly I was on the porch. I scurried into the backyard. Mike and Denny flew out the back door, panting and yet not pursuing. Instead, they seemed somewhat impressed by my feat. "He dove," Mike said, breathless. "Out the window," Denny finished for him. "Yes, I did. I dove."
"If we had a videotape of that, we could win $10,000 on America's Funniest Home Videos," Mike said.
"Give me the paper, Zenzo," Denny said. I shook them vigorously in my mouth. Mike laughed at my refusal. "It's not funny," Denny admonished.
"It's kind of funny," Mike replied in his defense.
"Give me the papers," Denny repeated. I dropped the papers before me and pawed at them. I dug at them. I tried to bury them. Again, Mike laughed. Denny, however, was very angry. He glared at me.
"Enzo," he said, "I'm warning you."
What could I do? Had I not made myself clear? Had I not communicated my message? What else was there for me to do? One thing only. I lifted my hind leg, and I urinated on the papers. Gestures are all that I have. When they saw what I had done, they couldn't help themselves. They laughed. Denny and Mike, they laughed so hard. Denny laughed harder than I'd seen him laugh in years. Their faces turned red. They could barely breathe. They fell to their knees and laughed until they could laugh no more.
"Okay, Enzo," Denny said. "It's okay."
I went to him then, leaving the urine-soaked papers on the grass.
"Call Lawrence," Mike said to Denny. "He'll print them again. You can sign them."
Denny stood.
"No," he said. "I'm with Enzo. I piss on their settlement, too. I don't care how smart it is for me to sign it. I didn't do anything wrong, and I'm not giving up. I'm never giving up."
"They're going to be mad," Mike said with a sigh.
"Screw them," Denny said. "I'm going to win this thing, or I'm going to run out of fuel on the last lap, but I'm not going to quit. I promised Zoe. I'm not going to quit."
When we got home, Denny gave me a bath and toweled me off. Afterward, he turned on the TV in the living room.
"What's your favorite?" he asked, looking at the shelf of videotapes he kept, all the races we loved to watch together.
"Ah, here's one you like." He started the tape. Ayrton Senna, driving the Grand Prix of Monaco in 1984, slicing through the rain in pursuit of the race leader, Alain Prost. Senna would have won that race had they not stopped it because of the conditions. When it rained, it never rained on Senna. We watched the race together without pause, side by side, Denny and me.
50.
The summer of my 10th birthday came along, and there was a sense of balance to our lives, though none of completeness. We still spent alternate weekends with Zoe, who had grown so tall recently, and who never let a moment pass without questioning an assumption, or challenging a theory, or offering an insight that made Denny smile with pride. My hips had healed poorly from the accident, but I was determined not to cost Denny any more money, as I had at the animal hospital that night. I pushed through the pain, which at times prevented me from sleeping through the nights. I tried my best to keep up with the pace of life. My mobility was severely limited, and I couldn't gallop or canter, but I could still trot fairly well. I felt that I had pulled off my end of it, as I sometimes heard people who knew my background comment on how frisky I looked or how dogs in general heal quickly and easily adapt to their disabilities. Money was still a constant struggle for us, since Denny had to give the evil twins a portion of his paycheck, and Mr. Lawrence, the level-headed lawyer, always demanded that Denny's account be kept up to date. Fortunately, Denny's bosses were generous in allowing him to change his schedule frequently so he could attend his various meetings, and also so he could teach driving on certain days at Pacific Raceways, which was an easy way for Denny to make more money to pay for his defense. Sometimes, on his driving school days, Denny would take me with him to the track, and while I was never allowed to ride with him, I did enjoy sitting in the stands and watching him teach.
I became known as a bit of a track dog, and I especially liked trotting through the paddock, looking at the latest fashion in cars purchased by the rich young men and women whose bank accounts were fed with heaping piles of technology monies. From the nimble Lotus Exige to the classic Porsche to the more flamboyant Lamborghini, there was always something good to see. On a hot day at the end of July, we were teaching, I remember, and while they were all out on the course, I watched as a beautiful red Ferrari F430 drove through the paddock and up to the school headquarters. A small, older man climbed out, and the owner of the school, Don Kitch, came to meet him. They embraced and spoke for several minutes. The man strolled to the bleachers to get a view of the track, and Don radioed to his corner workers to checker the session and bring in the students for lunch break. As the drivers climbed out of their vehicles and the instructors gave them helpful comments and pointers, Don called for Denny, who approached, as did I, curious about what was going on.
"I need a favor," Don said to Denny,
and suddenly the small man with the Ferrari was with us.
"You remember Luca Pantone, don't you?" Don asked. "We came to dinner at your place a couple of years ago."
"Of course," Denny said, shaking Luca's hand.
"Your wife cooked a delightful dinner," Luca said. "I remember it still. Please accept my sincere and heartfelt condolences."
When I heard him speak with his Italian accent, I recognized him immediately. The man from Ferrari.
"Thank you," Denny said quietly. "Luca would like you to show him our track," Don said. "You can grab a sandwich between sessions, right? You don't need lunch."
"No problem," Denny said, pulling on his helmet and walking to the passenger side of the exquisite automobile.
"Mr. Swift," Luca called out. "Perhaps you would do me the favor of allowing me to be the passenger so that I may see more."
Surprised, Denny looked at Don. "You want me to drive this car?" he asked. After all, the F-430 is priced at nearly $250,000.
"I accept full liability," Luca said.
Don nodded.
"I'd be pleased to,"
Denny said, and he climbed into the cockpit. It was an extremely beautiful car. And it was outfitted, not for street use, but for the track, with ceramic brake rotors, one-piece FIA homologated racing seats and harnesses, a full roll cage, and, as I had suspected, F1-style paddle shifters. The two men strapped in, and Denny pressed the electronic start button, and the car fired to life. Ah, what a sound! The whine of the fantastic engine layered over the throaty rumble of the massive exhaust. Denny flicked the paddle shifter, and they cruised slowly through the paddock toward the track entrance. I followed Don into the school classroom, where the students were clutching thick hunks of a giant sandwich, chewing and eating and laughing, their intense morning of track time having injected a week's worth of joy into their lives.
"If you drivers want to see something special," Don said, "grab your sandwiches and come out to the bleachers. There's a lunch session going on."
The Ferrari was the only car on the track, as the track is usually closed during the lunch hour. But this was a special occasion.
"What's going on?"
one of the other instructors asked Don.
"Denny's got an audition,"
Don replied cryptically. We all went out to the bleachers in time to see Denny come around turn 9 and streak down the straight.
"I figure it'll take him 3 laps to learn the sequential shifter," Don said.
Sure enough, Denny started slowly, like he had driven with me back at Thunderhill. Oh, how I wished I could have traded places with Luca. That lucky dog. To be co-pilot to Denny in an F-430 must be an amazing experience. He was driving easy, but as he came around for the third time, there was a noticeable change to the car. It was no longer a car. It was a red blur. It no longer whined. It screamed as it shot down the straightaway so fast that the students laughed at each other as if someone had just told a dirty joke. Denny was laying down a hot lap. A minute later, so fast one wondered if he had taken a shortcut, the Ferrari popped out of the cluster of trees at the exit of Turn 7, cresting the rise until its suspension was totally extended. And then, with a puck, puck, puck sound, we heard the electronic clutch quickly downshift from 6th to 3rd, and we saw the ceramic brake rotors glow red between the spokes of the magnesium wheels. And then we heard the throttle open full and watched the car slam through the sweeping Turn 8 as if it were a rocket sled, as if it were on rails, its hot, rubber racing compound tires grabbing the greasy pavement like Velcro, and then, puck, shifting up and, puck, blasting past us at Turn 9, no more than 2 inches from the concrete barrier.
The Doppler effect of the passing car converted its snarl into an angry growl, and off it rocketed. Puck! Shifting again at the kink, and it was gone.
Holy shit,
a student said. I looked back at them, and their mouths were agape. We were all silent, and we could hear that sound. Puck, puck, as Denny set himself up for turn 5A on the backside of the track, which we couldn't see, but which we could imagine, given such wonderful sound effects. And again, Denny careened past us at a million miles an hour.
How close to the edge is he?
Someone asked aloud. Don smiled and shook his head.
He's way past the edge, he said. I'm sure Luca told him to show him what he could do, and that's what he's doing.
Then he turned to the group and shouted,
Don't you ever drive like that. Denny is a professional race car driver, and that's not his car. He doesn't have to pay for it if he breaks it.
Lap after lap, around they went until we were dizzy and exhausted from watching them. And then the car slowed considerably, a cool-down lap, and pulled off into the paddock. The entire class gathered around as Denny and Luca emerged from the burning hot vehicle. The students were abuzz. They touched the scalding glass window that shielded the magnificent power plant and exclaimed at the spectacular drive.
Everyone into the classroom, Don barked. We'll go over corner notes from your morning sessions.
As they headed off, Don clasped Denny's shoulder firmly.
What was it like?
It was incredible, Denny said.
Good for you. You deserve it.
Don went off to teach his class. Luca approached and extended his hand. In it was a business card.
I would like you to work for me, Luca said with his thick accent.
I sat next to Denny, who reached down and scratched my ear out of habit.
I appreciate that, Denny said, but I don't think I'd make a very good car salesman.
Neither do I, Luca said.
But you're with Ferrari.
Yes, I work in Marinello, at Ferrari headquarters. We have a wonderful track there.
I see, Denny said. So you'd like me to work where?
At the track. There is some need, as often our clients would like track instruction in their new cars.
Instructing?
There is some need, but mostly you would be testing the vehicles.
Denny's eyes got extremely large, and he sucked in a huge breath of air, as did I. Was this guy saying what we thought he was saying?
In Italy, Denny said.
Yes, you would be provided with an apartment for you and your daughter, and, of course, a company car, a Fiat, as part of your compensation package.
To live in Italy, Denny said, and test drive Ferraris.
See.
Denny rolled his head around. He turned in a circle, looked down at me, and laughed.
Why me? Denny asked. There are 1,000 guys who can drive this car.
Don Kitsch tells me you are an exceptional driver in wet weather.
I am, but that can't be the reason.
No, Luca said. You are correct.
He stared at Denny, his clear blue eyes smiling.
But I would prefer to tell you more about those reasons when you join me in Marinello, and I can invite you to my house for dinner.
Denny nodded and chewed his lip. He tapped Luca's business card against his thumbnail.
I appreciate your generous offer, he said, but I'm afraid certain things prevent me from leaving this country, or even this state, at the moment, so I have to decline.
I know about your troubles, Luca said. That is why I am here.
Denny looked up, surprised.
I will keep the position available for you until your situation is resolved and you can make your decision free from the burden of circumstance. My telephone is on my card.
Luca smiled and shook Denny's hand again. He slipped into the Ferrari.
I wish you would tell me why,
Denny said. Luca held up his finger.
Dinner. At my home. You will understand.
He drove away. Denny shook his head in bewilderment as the high-performance driving school students emerged from the classroom and headed for their cars. Don appeared.
Well?
He asked.
I don't understand,
Denny said.
He's taken an interest in your career since he first met you,
Don said.
Whenever we talk, he asks how you're doing.
Why does he care so much?
Denny asked.
He wants to tell you himself. All I can say is that he respects
how you're fighting for your daughter.
Denny thought for a moment.
But what if I don't win? He asked. There is no dishonor in losing the race, Don said. There is only dishonor in not racing, because you are afraid to lose. He paused.
Now get to your student, Grasshopper, and get the hell out on the track. That's where you belong.
You need to go out? Let's go out.
He was holding my leash. He wore his jeans and a light jacket for the fall chill. He lifted me to my unsteady feet and clipped on the leash. We went out into the darkness. I had fallen asleep early, but it was time for me to urinate. I had been experiencing a decline in my health. I don't know if my accident the previous winter had knocked something loose in my plumbing, or if it was somehow associated with the medication that Denny gave me, but I had developed an inconvenient case of urinary incontinence. After even mild activity, I often slept deeply and awoke, having soiled my bedding. It was usually only a few dribbles, though on occasion it was more extensive, and it was always horribly embarrassing. I also was having great difficulty with my hips. Once I was up and moving, once I had warmed up my joints and ligaments, I felt fine and was able to move well. However, whenever I slept or lay in one spot for any amount of time, my hind joints locked in place, and I found it difficult to get them moving again, or even to rise to a standing position. The net result of my health issues was that Denny could no longer leave me alone for an entire workday. He began visiting at lunchtime so he could take me out to relieve myself. He was very kind, and explained to me that he was doing it for himself. He was feeling stagnant, he said, and frustrated. The lawyers continued at their glacial pace, and there was nothing Denny could do to speed them along, so he looked at the short walk from his work to the apartment and back as a tonic. It allowed him a certain amount of cardiovascular exercise, yes, but it also gave him a purpose, a mission, something to do other than wait. That evening, it was around 10, I knew, because the amazing race had just finished, Denny took me out. The night was bracing, and I enjoyed the feeling of wakefulness as I breathed in through my nostrils, the energy. We crossed Pine Street, and I saw people smoking outside the Cha-Cha Lounge. I forced myself to ignore the urge to sniff the gutter. I refused to shove my nose into the butt of another dog making the rounds. And yet I urinated on the street like an animal, because that was the only alternative I was afforded. To be a dog. We walked down Pine toward the city, and then she was there. Both of us stopped. We held our breaths. Two young women at an outdoor table at Bauhaus Books and Coffee, and one of them was Annika. Temptress. Seducer. Vixen. How awful for us to have to see this horrid girl. I wanted to leap at her and take her nose in my teeth and twist. How I hated this young girl who attacked my Denny with her unrestrained sexuality and then blamed him for the attack. How I despised she who would rend this family because of her own agenda. A woman scorned, indeed. Kate Hepburn would smash her with a single blow and laugh while doing it. How my anger burned. At Bauhaus, she sat at an outdoor table with another girl. At this hip and cool coffee shop in our neighborhood, she sat drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. She was at least 17 by now, possibly 18, and was legally allowed to function in society on her own. Technically, she could sit at any coffee shop in any city and stew in her wretchedness. I couldn't stop her, but I didn't have to deal with her. Immature finger-pointer, inflictor of wounds. I thought we would cross the street to avoid a confrontation, but instead, we headed straight for her. I didn't understand. Perhaps Denny hadn't seen her? Perhaps he didn't know? But I knew, and so I resisted. I set my weight. I ducked my head. "Come on, boy," Denny ordered me. He tugged at my leash. I refused. "With me," he snapped. "No,
I would not go with him. And then he leaned down. He kneeled and held my muzzle and looked me in the eyes.
I see her too, he said.